Thanks, Dan. Well, I'm excited to talk to you about visionary leadership, is the title that I was given, because that's what I do, and I spend a lot of time doing that. So I know that your desire is to build healthy churches, effective churches. I didn't grow up in a large church. My dad was a Baptist minister, and the church I grew up in was 100 people. Met my wife in the junior high group. And so I didn't grow up in a large church and never really set out to be a large group, a large church. It's just kind of what happened. So I'm going to tell you part of that story, but I want to give you a context for what you're looking at. If you've been around the buildings, I'm going to show you some things that will help you kind of understand the story that I'm going to tell you. First of all, this property originally was South Coast Community Church. And can you, I don't know if you can see this, but I think you can. All right, and it sat on 13 acres, and it was right here, okay? You're sitting in a building that's right here. So it's up in this area. You're upstairs in a building here. Those two buildings over there were the only two buildings that were South Coast Community Church, and then they have some temporary buildings and stuff like that. So that was the original site of South Coast Community Church. Okay? You get a sense of that? I'm going to talk to you about Imagine One when we raised the money to buy the land that you're on. It's about 20 acres, and we bought it for $1.2 million an acre. That's a deal. Yeah, I think it was the most, and that was in the year 2000. The campus that you're on now, can you see that in the back? Kind of? All right. You're sitting up here in this building right in here. This is a building, the auditorium's there. We have a big playground area. This is a children's building that Dale just talked about. And then here are the two original buildings. This is a life development building, kind of adult education. This is the old auditorium that's being turned into a large meeting space. We flatten the floor. We have 2,200 parking spaces, and that's where we are right now. But it doesn't make sense to look at it, because the buildings, if you look at it, you go, why did you do that? And so I want to give you a sense of what we're doing just so you understand, because when we designed the campus, I met with different architects and finally walked out on them, because our goals were to create a spiritual place where people could connect with God. We wanted church for a day, meaning that people could come to church. Not everybody could stay for the day, but ministries could stay for the day. Different ministries could, and as they chose. And that we wanted it to be great tools for ministry. And so as I tried to work with architectural firms to design a church, what I found out is that they can't design for ministry. And so I ended up walking out of these meetings with really high-paid architectural firms, and finally found a firm that could design a church campus. You know where I had to find it? Christian Camp. So a firm that developed Christian camps helped me come up with what is the long-term structure of this church. And so here's the ultimate design of the facility. What it has is a big parking structure up here that's 2,500 cars. It goes up into that hill, so you can imagine. You can enter and exit it on different levels. There's a 6,000-seat auditorium that goes between these two buildings and back set up in there. So that's how they fit together, why the children's building today feels so far from this building. Then a youth building, and then a chapel, and then the two buildings. So it's fit together with a 5-acre park in the middle of it. It's much more of a university kind of a campus. Does that make sense? So that's why it looks funky the way that it is now. Our next step is to build a youth center, which will be right here, and then a chapel that's right there that seats about 250. And so that'll be it. And then what it does is it boxes in this 5-acre park so that it'll feel more symmetrical. It'll make sense. So I wanted you to kind of understand what we're trying to do with that. So I don't know if that helps or not, but that's for free. All right. What I want to talk to you about as far as in visionary leadership is this, three things. I think as pastors, we have to know who we are. We need to know and embrace the people that God has given to us on the journey that we're going through, specifically volunteer leaders, and then the staff that we have, whatever size staff that is, or whoever we have, paid or full-time paid staff. And then third, we have to have a way to evolve and to change. And so I want to talk to you about those three things, because I think from a leadership standpoint, that is, in essence, the most important thing. Knowing who you are, embracing the people that God has given you, and then third, having a structure that you can evolve and change with. It allows you to change, allows the staff to change, and allows the structure to change. You have on your tables this sheet. I want to kind of explain it to you, and then I'm going to work through it and give you kind of a way of thinking about this. Now, I know that if you've read about churches, there's probably lots of things that you've seen about how churches reach certain sizes, and then they have to have a breakthrough. And when I'm talking about a church growing, I'm not really talking about just growing numerically. I'm just talking about as you reach certain places, there's things that have to change. And so more than a church growth model, this is more of a model that is, it's a way of thinking about change. And I coach 10 senior pastors, and we meet about 5 times a year. And their churches are anywhere from about 2,000 to 5,000 in attendance. And so I use this paradigm to kind of work with them in the issues that they face. So I'm going to run through it kind of with you quickly, that it serves as a backdrop for some things that I'm going to say. So there are 8 things or subjects that the church must manage to grow or to change. The role of the senior pastor. So if you're a senior pastor, that's an ever-evolving role. My first Sunday at Mariners Church, there were 223 people in attendance the first week I was there. And so you can imagine that my role has changed a lot. And so you have to have a world where you can change and your role can change. And so there's 2 things. Now you see, okay, look over at the green pyramid deal below. 2 things that I want to emphasize. As you grow in a church, the tension between all of 8 of these happens at the same time, meaning you have tension in all 8 of these areas as a church is growing or when it stops growing and it needs to take its next step. Most people try to, you know, tinker with the dial of one of these things to try to change their church. In my opinion, it takes changing all 8 things at the same time if you're going to effectively change your church. When you try to just change one of the things on the list, it never affects long-term change. Your church just kind of recoils back, or it snaps around, or you can't figure out, why is it that I can't move this to the next level? And so what you have to do is kind of manage all 8 of them at the same time. And that's why I think churches are such a complex organism, because it's not like business. Business manages essentially 3 things at once. It's got to have its people, its product, and then the people who buy it, its customers. It's just 3 things. All business is built on a 3-legged stool. And churches are built on a much more complex system, and you've got to manage all of those things at the same time. First of all, the role of the senior pastor. When I started, it was a very professional role. Mostly I did lots of the things that the church had to do, and I had a team of volunteers that kind of helped me do it, and there was just 3 or 4 people on staff. From there, I moved to a much more executive role, and as a church grows, you evolve to an executive role. And an executive model is a much better model for a senior leader, because at least you're trying to mobilize a group of volunteers, which takes an executive mindset. You got to be committed to funding the vision. The one thing that I never understood when I became a senior pastor is that money is critical to funding a vision. A vision without money is just a dream. It's just a dream. And it stays a dream if you're not willing to fund whatever it is that God's called you to do. And raising money is one of the hardest things that I've had to learn how to do. Didn't know how to do it. And then a visionary leader has to grow at each step, so that wherever you are, you have to evolve and you have to change your role if your church is going to evolve. Even if it doesn't grow numerically, but it grows in its effect, you have to change and you have to grow. My experience, it's the senior pastor who keeps a church from growing. So I think it's our fault typically, because we're unwilling to change the way that we operate. Secondly, governance. Governance is probably, it's a perfect name for it, because it's a governor to growth. It's a governor to leadership. A lot of times the way that you're structured governs your ability to move forward. I only know independent churches, but I have a board that I work for. I am not like in a Calvary Chapel type of a church or the kind of situation that Rick Warren is in where the board doesn't really play an important role. The board plays a real role at our church. It has real power, and it has real power over me. And so I have to work with that. Denominations, I don't totally understand. I just know that you still have to deal with governance, whatever that means. And then, so you've got to get your board to be primarily strategic. And then staff, you've got to get your staff to run the day-to-day operations. It's got to get in the hand of professionals or professional volunteers that are doing it. And in a large church, you pay by opportunity and performance, and that's what we do. Volunteers, you move from volunteer training, which is what most churches think of as volunteers, to volunteer development, and then beyond volunteer development, you do volunteer leadership development, and it's got to be your core competency. So in our church, and you'll hear later about the leadership team that we have, Gene Mulway will come and talk to you a little bit about how volunteer leadership development is our core competency. We have to develop great volunteer leaders to do the things that we're called to do as a church. And that has to be a core competency of a church. Not just volunteer, not training and not just developing volunteers, it is creating great volunteer leaders. And then your program, complexity, your budget grows, your vision and values have to become more and more tight, and they have to be more clearly defined. And you got to hear Rick, I'm sure, and Rick is a great example of somebody who has really defined vision, values, and purpose. And then your facilities have to be an expression of your vision. Winston Churchill said, we create our institutions, and then our institutions create us. And so for better or for worse, your facilities that define you. And so you've got to have facilities that allow you to define yourself your way. And then speed. The larger you grow, the faster you move, which is... it's a surprising thing to me. I would have thought it's easier for a small church to move faster. And as I've experienced churches, small churches move incredibly slow and large churches move incredibly fast. It's just the nature of their beast because you can't get large without moving fast. And so that's kind of a paradigm that I want to lay over the story that I want to tell you, which is largely my story. And then I want to just tell you my story. You can pick parts out of it that you like or don't like, and you can use it as you want. All right? So I'll tell you about myself. I grew up, as I said, my dad was a Baptist minister. I grew up actually in a small church. I then went to Biola College. In Biola College, I started working as a youth pastor in a small church. And that's where I kind of figured out that I really was called to ministry because ministry worked. We had about 125 adults in this church that I worked in, and we had about 150 high school kids, which is what I was involved with. So we outnumbered the adults on our midweek service. So it was very exciting, and I was at Biola College, and I went to Talbot Seminary, which is a local seminary in California. How many of you from California? How many are mostly out of state? The rest of you? Wow. Okay, well, then I'll have to shift a little bit. Talbot, Biola is a local college seminary. I've grown up in Southern California my whole life. I was born down in Oceanside. So in 1978, I came to Mariners Church as a college pastor, and Joe Aldridge, who became the president of Multnomah, wrote Lifestyle Evangelism, was the pastor at Mariners Church. He left shortly after I came, and then Mariners Church was without a pastor. And then it went through three, four different senior pastors and went through a lot of pain. At the end, because it didn't know how to hire a senior pastor well, Mariners Church did not, because you have to match, as you know, a church and its DNA with a pastor or a senior leader in its DNA. And if it doesn't match, you have all sorts of pain in a church. And that's what happened. And Mariners mishired three or four times in a row. And so by 1984, it was down to about 220 people. They hired me as the senior pastor. I had no senior pastor experience. I worked at a youth pastor, worked as a college pastor, and so this was my first experience. What I did is I wrote a letter to the board at Mariners Church saying who I was. I was 29 years old at the time. I wrote five things that define me as who I am. I'm 52 now. I still hold these five things. I am surprised that at 29, I could identify so clearly who I was and what I'm about and what I believe about church. Now, I'd grown up in the church. My dad was a minister, as I said, and as I have a bias for people who grow up in the church. When we hire people on staff, if I've heard that they're parents, our staff, you know, they've worked as a church person. That's a huge bias. I tend to move at those people because people who grow up in the church understand church better than people who don't grow up in the church. It's just the way things are. People who come to the church late, you know, they can learn things, but they don't get at the core of their being some things that a church is. I grew up in the church. I didn't even know what I knew about church, but I just knew stuff about church. So here are the five things that I defined who I was, and they are still true today, and it's they're five driving values of our church. Because the leader, the, you know, becomes the shadow of the church cast long. Who I am, Mariners reflects. You can't separate me from Mariners too easily anymore. Now, Mariners is bigger than I am, but Mariners would go through a big change if I changed out, and they'd have to find somebody who matched these five values somewhat. Here are the five values. This is what I wrote to the church. If you hire me as their senior pastor, I know how to do one thing. I've been trained how to do it. I've seen it all my life. This is what I do. I teach God's word. That's all I know how to do. So I'll come and I'll teach God's word. That's what will happen on the weekend services. But I know how to teach God's word. I can go through the Bible. That's what I know. I'll teach God's word. Secondly, I believe that the church is God's family. I think it's the most compelling thing to a lost world, the beauty of the bride of Christ, the family of God. And when the church is a loving family, not just families, you know, but it is a family together, old, young, children, singles, and it operates as a family, the beautiful bride of Christ. It is attractive to people. It is attractive to the world. I grew up in a family. I understand family. I had a healthy family. I grew up in a church, and it was a small Baptist church, which, you know, has an ugly underbelly, but I loved it just the same. And so there's never been a church that I've seen that I don't love. I love the church. And so I understand that the church is a family, and I said, I want this church to be a family. I understand what makes it a family, so I work hard at that. So I can teach God's word. The church is God's family. Third is every believer is a minister with a ministry. You know, that's not new to any of you, but that's what I believe and what I was all about when I was a high school pastor, a college pastor, is that I invested my life in seeing people become ministers, seeing what God had called them to do, whether it was paid or professional, whatever, and say, I am all about training and equipping you to help you be the minister that God's called you to be. The fourth, which I had no idea was so wise, and I wish I could take credit like this was the smartest thing, but in the long run, this fourth value has played the highest dividends. I said I wanted to be a part of a church that was innovative in its ministries and relevant to its community. Now, what I didn't know and what I learned over the long run is that gave me a credit card to change that I needed. Because every time we ran into something and people would go, yeah, but we haven't done it that way, or how do we know? We'd go, well, we're innovative. We say we're innovative. We're a church that's innovative. So if it's new, we have a predisposition to try it. Even if we don't think it's going to work, we're going to try it. Even if it's not broke, we're going to break it just to try to fix it a new way, because we're going to be innovative and we're going to be relevant to our community. And so as a church, it defined us for the future. It was a value that at the very core created a sense of urgency to change. And then the last one is that I'd said back then lifestyle evangelism, but if you've read Contagious Christian by Mark Middleberg, you'll see that Joe Aldridge's book is footnoted all the time. And so we just say we're a church of contagious Christians. But by that, what I mean is that as a church, our style of evangelism is building relationships with the lost world one at a time, building redemptive relationships where we have a conversation with somebody who is lost and then we bring them to the Lord. I model that. I do that. I've tried lots of things these days. The way I do that is I am an extremely good coffee drinker. And so I drink coffee as a lifestyle evangelism approach. I have a coffee shop that I go to in my local community, and I meet with about 10, 12 different guys that don't know Jesus, and these are people that are far from the Lord, and I share my story with them, and I've seen a couple of them come to know the Lord. I tell the stories about what I do to the church all the time, and I model investing in a relationship, inviting them to church, and that model. Because I believe what's so critical about that is this. Vision starts with a lost world. If you start your vision with a mentality of equipping people, you never get there. You have to start with a lost world. So if you start your vision with a lost world and you see the people that you are talking to, your leaders, just like Jesus did. Jesus saw the world, the change. You know, he believed that those 12 people, the 120, could invest, he could invest in them and they would change the world. But he invested in them to change the world. He saw a lost world. And so when I speak at Mariners, I think of the lost community. I think of the communities that we surround, and I'm trying to build into them because there is a lost world behind them. I am always looking at the lost world. I personally don't try to do messages that try to bring in the whole lost world because they don't want to come and listen to me. I mean, the reality is we do many series where we try to get people to invite their friends, and that, you know, and that's exciting and it's important, but most of the people that come to a church are convinced, no matter what people say, you know, they tend to be convinced people. And so I think that if you see the lost world through their eyes, if you believe you can change the community by investing in them, that's how you make a difference. But you can't take your eyes off of the lost world, because if you do, the people that you're speaking to will immediately want you to create a church for them. And that's what has been my history, is that the people who are sitting in the church always like the church the way that it is. But the reality is, I think pastors hold the responsibility of having this thought ever present in their mind. There are more people who will attend my church in the next 10 years than presently attend it. Somebody has to speak for those people who have not yet come. Somebody has to have a vision for those people who have not yet come. They are the future of the church, and they tend to be younger people than whoever is there today. They will be younger, and so somebody has to speak for them. And today, my church, if I stop pressing it, would allow itself to become old and become stagnant. And so the staff's job, my job, is to ever present, keep a lost world at focused on them, and that there are many more people coming to the church in the future than are coming today, and somebody has to protect their future. So five things, you got them? So that's who I am. And that's who I was from the very beginning of the church. And so I said, that's who I am. That's what I'm about. And so the church hired me in 1984 to be their senior pastor. And so I started off. We started a Christian school in 1986, which was an interesting venture that my wife made me do because we have four boys. And then we let it become its own nonprofit, which was the smartest thing I ever did. And it's still going great. And it's over that way about 8 miles. And so we're no longer connected to the school. The church had gone through 4 years of decline before I came as a senior pastor, and so the first thing I did was settle the church, and then the church began to grow. Started in 84. By 87, we started thinking about new buildings. We designed the buildings in 88. We did a fundraiser 88 and built the building in 89 and went into it, and it sits about 3 miles as a bird flies over in that direction. And the only reason that's important is it's going to be important in kind of the story I tell you. So Mariners Church, that I actually was hired to be a part of, was over there, and it sat on 9 acres, and it was in an office building. We built an auditorium that sat about 1,400 people in kind of a family life building, and so we started to grow. From 90 to 93, I went through the fastest rate of change in my own professional life that I'd ever been in. Up until that point, in say 84 to about 89, I lived in a ghetto. I only knew what my seminary had taught me and what I had seen in a few churches in Southern California, which they were not very progressive churches. They were just really big churches in Southern California, but they weren't very contemporary and they weren't very thoughtful. They just were big. They were kind of proclamation model churches. And so I got through Leadership Network, if you know who they are. Bob Buford started it in like 89, and I got involved in it, and I got to see the church and what was happening in the nation, and it just absolutely startled me. I didn't realize there were that many things happening in the church. 89, if you came to Mariners Church, we had a piano and an organ, and our music was, you know, like 1954. And every place I went out around and I saw churches that were growing, they had bands. And there was this big argument in 89, 90 about, you know, what the music of the church would be like. It was like a joke. It had already changed, and it was moving forward. So we began to change our music style. We began to change our service style. We began to change the way we did things, which just traumatized the church. Because up until that point, I had been kind of safe and sane as a pastor. I was trying to figure out my way. We just moved into a new building, and then I shifted everything. I shifted all 8 of those things on your page at the same time. And the church was rattling. I was rattling. I couldn't figure out who I was, what I was doing. And so there were three things that rescued me at that time. And it was this one principle. First, you got to know who you are. Secondly, you got to have people in your life that can help you. And so, three things. I started meeting with four other pastors in 90, and we did it till about 94, 95, 96, somewhere in there, for about 5 years. Rick Warren, myself, Chuck Smith Jr., and Denny Bellesi. And the four of us began to meet together, and we just talked about what was going on in our churches for about 4 or 5 years. They were other professionals. I got to see the church through their eyes. We would go to conferences together. We would be around different things together. I got just to see the church, and they pressed me forward, and they helped me during that formative time when I had to figure out who I was and what it was going to look like. The five things that I told you about have never changed. But what we look like as a church, with a style of music, the future of a church, all of those things, those guys helped me, and we would talk it through. Secondly, I got a group of leaders that were very sophisticated leaders in our church together. They're called the Group of Six. I still meet with them. And they were guys that I trust, that are super committed to me. They go to the church, but they're very entrepreneurial. They own their own companies, and they have gifts that I don't have. Because the one thing that would mark my early part of, say, the first 10 years of my senior pastor's life is I didn't know how to work with other people. I know how to do what I do very well, but I don't know how to work with the staff. Some of my staff is in the room, and they will laugh because they still don't know, they still think I don't know how to work with them very well. And that's probably true, but it was way worse the first years that I was a senior pastor, because basically I kept hiring people, but I didn't manage them. And when somebody said, show me an organizational chart, the organizational chart had a whole bunch of pastors basically answering to the building. You know, they would come and they'd show up, and if they were good, they stayed, and if they weren't good, we let them go. But there was no way to train them, there was no way to develop them, and I didn't know how to do it. I knew how to do my job, I didn't know how to help them do their job. I didn't know how to effectively embrace the people that God had given to the church and given to me to take the next step in the journey. I just didn't. Our church was full of very talented people that were sitting on the sidelines. They knew everything that I needed to know. But I kept screwing it up, and staff kept coming and going, and we looked like a revolving door, and we couldn't keep, you know, good staff stayed, but we couldn't help, you know, good enough staff kind of find their way. And I had to learn. And so I learned professionally by the group of senior pastors I was with. These guys came to me, and they really invested in my life. They helped me figure out how to work with people, how to create systems to hold people. They spent a lot of time just helping me be a better manager, because I hate management. And visionary leaders, as a rule, hate management. And I don't like it. It's not that I can't do it. I can do it. I don't want to do it, and I don't like it, and I don't even like that we have to have it. And it annoys me when I sit in meetings, and I get more hostile. The longer I'm in a meeting, my hostility rate keeps growing. So it's like, you know, and the staff knows. They go, don't keep Kenton in meetings, because things will go bad, and he'll start making decisions, and it won't work well for us. And it just happens. I become more pissy the longer I sit in meetings. And that's probably not a good Baptist word, right? Is that? I don't think you can say that. That's right. Just can't say it in front of the church. So I had to learn how to work with people. And so they helped me do that. The thing that I always could do, I can do a clear, compelling vision. I got that. And I can do that. But what I had to do is learn how to help the staff do a clear, compelling vision with me. And so for me, it's very easy to stand up in front of a group and talk about who we are as a church and what is our next step and why we need to go there. But the issue was, how do we as a staff communicate a compelling vision? And one of the things that I had to learn during those years is how to embrace the staff and how could we communicate together a compelling vision. And one of the things that we did, and that's when I was around Rick a lot, and Bob Buford came out, and he helped us with consultants. And Rick's book, The Purpose-Driven Life Church, came out of that. And we worked together. I learned some lessons in that. And we have a system where you're going to see, we have an executive ministry team, which I'm going to introduce to you in about a half hour. And this is how we're managed. And it's not so different from the purpose-driven. I understand that. Our values are reach, belong, grow, serve, worship. And then we have a lead component because leadership development, volunteer leadership development, is our core competency. And so we have a pastor that's just aimed at that, helping us to build and equip volunteer leaders. The reason that that became so important was you cannot embrace a sophisticated staff and a great staff of professionals unless you articulate a vision that you can say as a team together. I did not need that. I don't need a reach belong. I don't need a clever, you know, Rick does them in M's or E's now, or C's, or however he does it. And so membership, maturity, he does M's. And so, you know, I don't need that. But if you're going to have a staff together, and if you're going to have a vision that isn't just said by one person to the church every time it needs to be said, but you're going to have a shared, cohesive vision that is communicated to all of your volunteer leaders essentially the same, you've got to begin to boil down your vision into a way that you can all say it together. And that's kind of the lesson that I learned from those other senior pastors and began to force myself. I was resistant to it. I don't know why. I just didn't like the idea of having to say the vision the same way and to go, you know, we want to be a church that reaches the lost people and then helps people belong to the church and then grow in loving community so they reach out and serve people with excellence so that, you know, we're Christ-like people and stuff. And that's the way we spit it out today. And I can spit it out like that. But it was very regimented. But I had to learn to control myself so that I could embrace the staff and we could work together because we wanted to create leaders for a lifetime. We wanted leaders to move from high school ministry, and they could move to children's ministry, they could move to men's ministry or women's ministry, and when they worked with the paid staff person, they'd hear the same language, the same leadership tools, they would understand how we did ministry as a church. And so 93, 94, 95, we began to codify that and began to build a structure that's a structure that you're going to hear about from the executive ministry team. And so today, the day-to-day workings of the church is run by what we call the executive management team, which are your value champions, the reach value champion, belong, grow, serve, lead, and worship. And those people run ministry. The dumbest thing that I ever did in the church is try to combine ministry and administration in the same position. It just never worked well. So if you can keep, just as a side note, if you can keep ministry and administration away from each other, the church works better. That's just free, all right? That's just my opinion on that. Okay, all right, I'm all wound up on that. Are you still with me? I can switch subjects. All right, 1996. So the church grew. By 1995, Mariners Church was over there, 9 acres. We had built, and we had 4 services, and they were full. We were saturated. The city of Newport Beach said, you cannot build any more buildings. You are a problem. You have too many cars coming to too small of a location, and we won't sell you any more land anyway. And so we were stuck. And so we were beginning to think about creating a second campus, straight up Jamboree and kind of the Irvine area, and we were looking at every solution that we could. In 1996, an article came out in the Atlantic Monthly that was written by a guy who did a year study of the church, and we were the lead church. Mariners Church was the lead church in that Atlantic Monthly article that was titled The Next Church. Our church was really good at that point. But right when that article came out, we had made the decision to combine Mariners Church that was over there with South Coast Community Church that was in those two buildings and on 13 acres. They had a common history. They were actually started out of the same original church, and then they divided in 1980. And so they had gone through about 4 years of decline, and the Irvine Company was looking to take over that land. And through a long story, we were able to combine the two churches. Essentially, this is how it worked. I was a senior pastor at Mariners Church. We were landlocked. We had 4 services. We couldn't go anywhere. They had big budget problems. I got my board to free me so that I was hired as the senior pastor of South Coast Community Church. So I became the senior pastor of two independent churches. And then we just figured out how to do the legal work behind it. Because I read a book on mergers and acquisitions, and there are three rules in doing a merger. And do you know what they are? I do. Speed, speed, and speed. That's it. You got to do it as fast as you can. And do you know who the number one obstacle is? The staff that works for you. The pastors that we had on staff, basically they said the people on, that work for you are the number one obstacle anytime you're trying to do a merger. And so we took all the pastors from South Coast Community Church, all the pastors from Mariners Church, and we locked them up in a building, and we said, you talk about the church that could be. Just dream and think about all the great things that could come about this. And we got them offline and away from all the people, and so we were able to do it. And that's really how we did it. We went fast, and the church hired me as a pastor, and then we figured out how to legally combine the two churches together. That was in 96. The only model of a church that I knew that was doing church on two campuses at that time was Church on the Way. And so we went up and looked at that, and we hadn't seen, and there wasn't this multiple venue and, you know, you videotape a service and then you show it. Nobody was doing that. And so when we combined the two churches, my thought was this: we can combine the two and maybe redivide them into two healthy churches. We can combine the two, and then we'll figure out how to do one church on two campuses, or we can combine the two and maybe get this land that we're on and buy it from the Irvine Company. Well, what happened is I had been the pastor of Mariners Church for 12 years, and as soon as we combined them, everybody that was on the Newport campus distrusted me. They thought I was leaving them. They thought, you know, things are going to go bad. The people at South Coast Community Church hadn't had kind of stability for a while, so they needed it. So I foolishly thought, well, I'll just do both services. So we had five services on a Sunday, on a weekend. We had a Saturday night service at the Newport campus, and we had four services on Sunday. The first service started at 8:30. They had two at Newport, 8:30 and 10:30, and we had two here, 9 and 11. So I did them all, and so did the worship team. So this is how it worked. Worship started at 8:30, went till 9, and they bust over here, and they started it at 9 o'clock here. I spoke from 9 to 9:30, and then I, 5 minutes after I said, you know, go in God's grace at the Newport campus, I was up giving the same message there, and we had 5 minute splits to get there, and it was wild. And we learned how to do church the way nobody should ever do church. We figured out how not to make that work, and it about killed us all. In fact, we killed our children's pastor. I mean, literally just broke him and he left. And we killed a worship pastor and he left, because it was no way to do church. And so we did that for 2 years, and it was the darkest, hardest years of our church's life. And it was stupid. And so in 1998, what we did is we traded away the Newport campus for the 12 acres that's just right down there. That's a big parking lot if you look that way. And then, and so when we announced that, 400 people walked out of our church. They said, we're not for that. Because the Newport campus was worth $3.5 million more than that land. And I would explain to the church, as I tried to sell them this concept, that it all belongs to God, right? And God isn't losing an acre. See, God owns this 12 acres. God owns that 9 acres. God doesn't lose in the deal. We get 25 contiguous acres. We've deed restricted, so both of them have to be church in perpetuity. It can never be anything. God owns it all. God isn't losing anything. And do you know what people said to that? That's not a good deal. We're leaving $3.5 million on the table. And he goes, who's leaving $3.5 million on the table? We are. They go, this church doesn't belong to you. Yes, it does. And it was a war. But we got through it somehow. And so we traded away. And today, that land is worth more than the land that we traded away from about 3 years afterwards. So I always kid the church and say, I'm a genius about 3 years after a decision. And that's about how it works. So we traded that. 1999, the church kind of went into like, okay, that's as fast, you know, as we can do anything. Then in 2000, we bought this land that you're sitting on, which is this upper part. That was about 20 acres that I told you we bought for $1 million, $1.2 million an acre. So we cast a vision. I'm a great visionary leader. I cast a great vision. We got 18% of our people involved in the giving campaign. They pledged $17 million. So we got just enough to buy the land, but not by very much. So we bought the land, and then we wanted to build these buildings on it, and so we cast a vision for that, and we got 30% of our people involved in that campaign, and we raised, Jim, $27 million? So we raised $27 million to build these two buildings. And so that's kind of how we got to where we are in that. What I didn't anticipate is how long it took to get there. If you would have come to me in 1999 and said, it's going to take you 6 years to buy land and to build buildings, I don't know that the staff would have stayed with me. I don't know if I would have chosen to do it. I just was kind of naive, and it was, well, if we can buy the land, I'm sure it'll happen sooner. But it didn't. In retrospect, I guess 6 years, it's kind of fast. But it was like climbing up a mountain the whole time. But we moved into it in November 2005. So we've only been into it a few months. The biggest mistake that we made moving into the buildings is we thought we anticipated all the big changes that would take place. But we didn't. Like, we knew there'd be big screens. If you've gone into the auditorium, there's big monster screens in there. And so we introduced those in the other auditorium. But just moving into a new place, different times for services, it just becomes a different church. And it's so easy to underestimate that. And we did. And so we kind of paid for it. So we learned a lot from that. These days, as a church, we've worked a lot on our culture, because we have to have the culture of your staff. Mariners Church is its staff now, and its staff runs all the ministries. And so we have to have a great staff. We work hard at being developmental for our staff, and we have gifted staff people. And so it's the job of the executive ministry team, the Reach, Belong, Grow, Serve, Lead people. The whole church staff works for them. And so we work really hard at creating a staff that works really good for them. So, three things that I'm telling you, and this is what my story says. You got to know who you are. From the day one, when I was 29 years old, I could tell the church who I was, and I'm still that. I am those five things. Now, the church has changed, and different things have been highlighted, but what I was is what I am, and I've continued to be that. I found ways to evolve. Then secondly, you've got to be able to embrace the people that you need. And that was one of the hardest things for me to learn. But our staff is a great staff. And it isn't a reflection of me, but it is a reflection of my willingness to work hard to work with great people, because I can't do it by myself. I have great volunteer leaders that work with me. I have great professional leaders that work with me. And you've got to have a way to evolve. This church has evolved so different. And my role and what I do today is so different than what it used to be. Today, my time is spent in studying God's word for weekend services. I speak 75% of the time on the weekend services because I like it. It's what I love to do. I love that we have a speaking team. They do a great job, and it's all I can do to free up the Sundays. I'm gone a lot, and when I'm gone, I'm with my family. As I said, I have four boys. I'm gone a lot of the summer, and then other times I get a lot of time off. I've been here a lot of years. And when I'm gone, mostly the speaking team speaks, but I speak 75% of the time. It's what I love, so I study God's word to speak. I communicate vision. It's what I do. What I do is talk about where God has brought us, what our next step is, and what we need to do together. And it's what I talk about all the time. I spend most of my time with a group of six that helps me in strategic planning. Those six guys that are gifted volunteers, run companies, they're very talented. I spend a lot of time with them. I spend a lot of time with the board. And I spend a lot of time with the executive ministry team that you're going to meet in a second, because they run the church. I meet with the staff two times a month. I meet with the pastoral staff one time a month, and I meet with the whole staff one time a month. The pastoral staff I meet from 1 to 3. Is it 1 to 3? 1 to 3, 2 hours. And it's a meeting where I just invest in them. I do creative things. I bust my butt to make it the most fascinating, insightful meeting. In fact, I'll show you what I do. I create up learning opportunities. How many of you seen American Idol? Okay, we'll create some excitement. Okay, American Idol is a phenomenon, right? It is one of the most exciting things happening in America today. I sit and I watch it. One time my son comes home from college and he says, "Hey, Dad, watch American Idol with me." I said, "Yeah, I don't want to watch it. It's, you know, it looks like a goofy singing competition to me." And he looks at me and he says, "Dad, there's more going on in this show than you think." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Oh, there's more going on." So I watch it with him and I come up with 10 leadership principles out of American Idol. So I go to the staff and I say, "I'm going to tell you 5 leadership principles, and if you can guess the other 4 that are on my piece of paper, I'll give you $100 for every one that you could guess that's on my piece of paper, all right? I'll give you 20, all right, if you can do it, because I don't like you as much as my staff, all right? So I'm going to give you the 10 leadership principles out of leadership development. Now, what are we talking about right now? Are you paying attention? We're talking about how I invest my time in the staff. I teach them. Now, I teach them a lot from God's word, and I'm assuming that you can do that. But I teach them a lot about leadership. So here are 10 leadership lessons. I'm going to give you 5. You can guess the other 4. I'll give you $20 for every one you get. All right? Here they are. First of all, first leadership lesson from American Idol. You've got to be excellent in execution. There is no such thing on American Idol of somebody, you cannot succeed unless every time you're out, you're excellent. You have to be excellent in execution. And you want to know what I think is one of the most important lessons in churches? You've got to be excellent. I go and look at 10 churches every summer. You know what the most wasted half hour in the church in America today? The first 30 minutes, the worship time. It is the biggest waste of people's time. It isn't done with excellence. There is no creativity. And I'm not talking about doing drama and everything. I'm just saying it's a waste of people's time. And it is, I go to churches and I think, this is wasting my time. Why should I come here? This is a waste of my time. And when you watch American Idol, they do it with excellence. First lesson, you got to have excellence in execution. Second thing, you've got to be memorable. How many times have you seen Simon say to the person, "That sounds like what I've heard in Las Vegas, you know, whatever," or "it sounds like karaoke"? It's like there's nothing memorable about that. You go to worship services the first 30 minutes, what is the biggest flaw? They're not memorable. There's nothing worth remembering in there. It's not memorable. It's not interesting. They don't execute well, and it doesn't matter what size you are. You can execute, and you can be memorable. You know what the rule, we have a guy who, but it's too much time, I'm losing. Okay, the third principle, American Idol, you must be likable. You just gotta be likable. You cannot move forward unless people like you. You've gotta be likable. And that's just true in churches. I mean, I think for all senior pastors, what's the one rule about senior pastors who succeed? You got to be likable, unless you grew up Baptist, because you can be mean if you're Baptist. And the reason, I'm just kidding, because I grew up Baptist, and I'm just kidding. Of course, it's a little true, but you've got to be likable. The American Idol, you can be the most talented singer, and you hear Simon Cowell says it all the time. He says, you know what? This isn't a singing contest. It isn't about the most talented person. You've got to show us your personality. You've got to be likable. And as you watch the American Idol, remember the little weasel kid that lasted for so long? What was his name? What? Kevin Covey's? Yeah, Chicken Little. That kid, you go, why is that kid in this competition? And the reason is because he was? Why didn't Ace make it? Because he's not likable. They just flat isn't. And so, you know, you just watch people. Those of you that don't watch American Idol have no clue as what we're saying right now. But you got to be likable. Here was the one that was most fascinating to me, and I actually learned a lot, and I changed to my worship people loved me because of these next two ones, because I used to be a pain to them. The third, fourth one is you've got to know your song. And if you watch American Idol, what you see the people saying over and over again to these talented people as they say, that was a bad song for you. You didn't choose right. And what's interesting is they don't tell them what's the right song to choose. They simply tell them it was the wrong song. And so they don't have a lot of coaching, but they just know that was wrong. And the American Idol, whoever it's going to be, knows how to choose their song. Here was the thing that was most fascinating to me. I believed, don't know why I believed it, I just believed it. I believed that talented people had greater bandwidth, meaning I would always say to our worship people, you guys are the most talented people. Why don't you do a little country? Why don't you do a little, can't you just do anything up there? You know, give me some Australian church, give me some Hillsong, give me some country, give me some time, you know, do it all. And because, you know, you're talented, you're the most talented people around, we pay you lots of money, do everything. And they'd look at me like, this guy's an idiot. And I was an idiot, because what I learned in American Idol is very talented people are very good at what they're talented at, and it's very small. And so, you know, Chris, he's really good at, who's not in it anymore, he's a rocker. And, you know, the gal that's still in it is a good singer. But you can see, the point is, and then the Kelly Pickler was Western, country Western, right? So it's like, be what you are. And here's the fatal remark in the early, because you learn more lessons in the early weeks than the later weeks. Here's the fatal remark. I'm going to show Simon a new side of me. And what did you know was going to happen to that person? They're out of there. They're not going any further. Why? Because they're trying something they're not good at. And they respect. Remember the crooner that was in it? They, you know, it's like, hey, you made yourself a joke because you didn't croon. As long as you were crooning, we liked you. But when you stopped crooning, and so it just changed my mentality. So now it's like, hey, to the worship people, they all love me now. Because I say, you be who you are, and you be the best who you are. You can't be great at everything. I was an idiot. You're right. You do what you do best. And I've stopped trying to push them to be everything. And you know what? The church likes them better. And you know what's funny about it? I only am who I am. I don't, you know, people try to say, hey, be everything, you know, be this, be that. I'm not funny, I don't tell jokes, okay? Can't do a contrived joke for the life of me. I can tell a story, but I can't tell a joke. Jokes aren't funny to me. I'm not a joke teller. People go, yeah, you go, not funny. So I don't try to tell jokes, never tried to tell jokes. But I'm whimsical. I do whimsical really well. I do certain things. But you know what? I stay in my bandwidth. And so I do that. So excellence in execution. Be memorable. Got to be likable. You got to know your song. And greater talent doesn't equal bandwidth. And then here's the next one. And now we're getting to the money. You must know your style and embrace it. It's not enough to know your song. You got to like your song. You got to like being you. And if you don't like being you and you stand up there, it's not attractive. So you not only have to be likable, you got to like who you are. You got to like being who you are. And so likability is a key thing. And it is compelling to watch somebody have fun. Did you watch it last night? Okay, the guy who I like the best, who's the soul guy, what's his name? Taylor. What did they say about Taylor? You are fun to watch because you're having fun. And that's the guy I want to win. And I don't like the girl. I don't like her. She's not likable. She seems hollow inside to me. She's not likable. And she doesn't seem to have fun when she's up there. But Taylor has fun. So I like him just because he likes having fun. All right. 5 lessons in leadership. $20 if you can get one on my piece of paper. What? Oh, you got it. That's right. All right. I got to give you $20. All right. Guy, right out of the gun. All right. $20, okay? Here's how I would say it. You got to know how to listen to a professional. Who's the guy you got to listen to? Simon or Randy. You got to listen to those people. And the dumb people go, you don't know what you're talking about. You've got to have a professional that's giving you input on an objective voice. You've got to be, and they develop, they listen to it. You've got to be a self-developer. It is not the making of an American Idol. It is the finding of American Idol. The American Idol, they figure it out on their own. Okay, what's another one? Confidence. No. That's just another way of saying they have fun. They do stuff like, don't take it personally. It's not one of mine. Yeah, that's one. America votes, all right, is the way I say it. Another $20. I'm going to get killed here. All right. The way I would say it is that America really votes, okay? And for churches, what does it say? How do you apply that? People really vote. People show up and they give money. And if people don't show up and they're not given money, it's their way of? They're voting. And they're voting. And the dumbest thing you can do is to say, people don't know what. You know, my church is a great church and they don't know what they're talking about. You're just one stupid American Idol is what you are. And you're off. Because you know what? People know. They know. And if you're a good church, Simon, the best guy in American churches, and you can't get to him anymore because he's got failing health, is Lyle Schaller. And Lyle Schaller came in. I remember I got him every time I could. I got around him every time I could. And he would be around pastors, and he had the greatest line. He says, I'll tell you about your church. If your church is growing, here's the thing you need to remember. Your church, if it's growing, is the least worst option. Is that good or what? He says, you're growing because you're not as bad as the guy down the street. That's why you're growing. He's saying, and you know what? People know. And if people aren't coming, the reality is, how many of you think that people have spiritual needs? Yeah, wait. How many, say it the other way, because you're not going to raise your hand. How many of you don't think people have spiritual needs? See, we all believe people have needs. They have a void in their heart. And you know what? If you're willing to meet those needs, people will show up. America votes. I'm not giving out any more money. I'll tell you what it is. Risk, you can't play it safe. And don't listen to Paula. In every church, after you give any message, there is a Paula Abdul that will say, that's the best message I've ever given. And you know who you can't listen to? Paula. She never says anything negative. And if you listen to her, you're as dumb as dirt. All right, 10 lessons. And it's an exciting thing. Okay. I gave you 9, so come up with the 10th on your own. I go to 10 churches a year. Every summer, I'm gone 6 weeks in the summer. I go to 10 churches. You know how hard it is to go to 10 churches? How hard is it to get to 10 churches? I get to 10 churches in 3 weekends. That's how hard it is. It's the easiest thing to do in the world. There are so many churches that have Saturday night services. I can go to a church, sometimes 2 churches on a Saturday night, and I can go to 2 or 3 churches on a Sunday. And if you go to 3 churches on a weekend, you can observe things about the American church. And I come back and I tell them things. What's the one thing you've already got that I can tell you about churches in America? That first 30 minutes is the biggest waste in the American church today. And it just flat is. And it is inexcusable. And we wonder why. It's a waste of their time. People get up and meander, and they go and they welcome people for 8 minutes, and they call it relationship building. And people, you just watch the whole congregation reel back going, this is the most boring thing in the world. I went to 10 churches last summer, and what I never heard from any one church, why I should be there. If you don't tell people why they should come, I think they're going to quit coming. Why should they be there? You tell me why somebody should show up on church. God's, aren't you glad to be here today because God's here? Nobody said that. Why else should they show up? What? You know what? Isn't it great to be together because we have the opportunity to love and bless people? Isn't it great to be here today because you're going to hear something from God's word? What else? Yeah, what? Truth? Yeah, you're going to hear God's truth. I didn't hear in 10 churches. I heard no reason why I should be there, especially in the first half hour. The pastor usually gave me a reason, but in the first 30 minutes, I heard from no worship pastor. So I came back throttling at my people going, hey, you better be sure and tell people it's good for them to be there and why they should be there. Another lesson, not going to go. I'm running out of time. Okay, I'm going to tell you I'll end up with a story. I got lots of stuff. So here's the last thing. All right, what I've learned, most important lesson I can tell you, in ministry, you got to learn how to pace yourself so you can make it in the long haul, right? You got to know who you are. You got to embrace the people that are with you. And you got to know, you got to have a way to change, but you got to make it in the long haul. There's lots of people who make it 4 or 5 years in ministry. There's no glory in that. There is beauty in people who do it 20, 30 years. Everybody admires that. So I'm going to tell you a story. Anybody from Texas? Really? You ever hear of the Wimberly Pie Company or Wimberly in Texas? My wife is from Texas. You're going to meet her in a second. And when I married her, she made me promise that I would go back to Texas every summer. And so we go back to Texas in the Austin area every August, which, why? Because it's like having 1,000 dogs pant on you when you're coming to Texas. It's just sticky and hot, and it is miserable. But her family's from Texas, so I go back, and we spend a month. And my boys have grown up. It's the greatest thing we do in our life, and it's actually a lot of fun. But when we go to Texas, there's two things that Texans know that the rest of us don't know, and that is they got the best ice cream in the world, which is Bluebell ice cream, and they have the best pie in the world, which is Wimberly pie. And if you've ever had Wimberly pie, you know, you can talk about all the pie you want, but Wimberly pie is flat the best pie in the world. Wimberly is up above San Marcos, and it's about a 45-minute drive from where we are. And so every year we go there, we have big family there. We have big family events with 50 people. And so I call up the Wimberly Pie Company, and I say, hey, do you have pies there? Now, they only work 3.5 days. They're open Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and half day Friday, all right? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and half day, 3.5 days. And they only stay open until they sell the pies they've made for that day, and they close. So if you call them up and you say, hey, what pies do you have? They'll tell you, but they're not real excited to tell you. And you say, will you save me 10 pies? I'm coming in. They go, well, we used to do that. But then people would come and they'd forget and stuff. And we'd end up staying here till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. So we don't do that anymore. It's just first come, first serve. And I go, great, but I'm driving from 45 minutes away. You know, I got to get there. And they go, no, you know, we used to do that. So I have to drive up from Wimberly. You have no promise the pies are going to be there. I got to get there early in the morning. Got to get there Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday because they sell. A lot of times they're closed at 1 o'clock. Doors closed, gone. We're gone. So I get there. Got to get there by 10 o'clock. I've literally been there at 10:30, bought 10 pies, and closed them down for the day. And they go, thanks. And they follow me out the door. So I try to explain to the Wimberly Pie Company that if they would hire employees, you know, because I'm thinking they just don't get it, you know, can't they think leverage, multiply, go bigger? So I'm saying, don't you get it? If you would hire some help, you know, and make these pies, you could make more pies, you could sell more, and you'd get more money. And they go, and this is what the guy said, we used to do that. But then I'd have to be training people all day long, and I was working 4, 5, 6 days a week. And I go, well, you'd have, you know, you could make all this money. And he'd go, what would I do with all the money? I got all the money I want. I take off a month, 2 months in the wintertime. I go to Europe. I go to, you know, the Bahamas. I go all these places. I got all the money I want. You could make more money. What would I do with all that money? And I'm trying to explain to this guy, I'm walking out so frustrated, going, doesn't he understand he could make more pies? If he just would spend more time, he'd get more money. And I'm sitting there, this guy is so frustrating. So I can't get him to do it. 3.5 days, all he's going to work, and he won't work any harder. And so I come to California, and I call him up, and I go, remember me? I'm the guy from California. I'm always driving you to, you know, try to stay up longer, make more pies. I remember you. I said, will you ship me 10 pies? We used to do that. But we were working 4, 5, 6 days a week, so we don't do that anymore. I know you didn't do it, but could you just do it this one time? You know, we used to do it. I called him up one time. Here's what's on his answering machine. Yeehaw! There's a text. This is the Wimberly Pie Company. We're on vacation. Click. No, when I left, no, when I'm getting back, we're on vacation, we're done. I go on their email site, and this is what it says. We used to monitor this thing, but we were getting orders, and people were calling us, and we were working, you know, an extra day of the week just to keep this up. We no longer pay attention to it. To a better life, the Wimberly Pie Company. Here's the point. When is ministry done? It's never done. I mean, you can work 5, 6, 7, 8 if you had them, 9, 10, 11. You can work nonstop. It is never done. Best lesson from these crazy Texan and Wimberly Pie, they work a certain amount of time, and when they're done, they're done. Most important lesson you can learn. All right, I want to introduce you to these people, and then I guess, are you supposed to be able to ask me questions now? Okay, that's what we'll do. All right, you have any questions? Yeah. Thirty percent of the giving units, and I guess we have 6,000 giving units or something. I don't know. Yeah, that'd be roughly. Oh, the question is kind of a giving thing. You know, how'd you figure out 30%? We have, say, if we have 6,000 giving units, you know how you track units, husband, whatever. 30% of them gave We don't have a formal membership, I guess is another way to say it. So we have people who give and we track people who give. And so 30% of them gave to building the buildings. Question? I have four boys, and I play with them, and they are just a kick. I have a motorcycle, and I ride them with some friends. So I ride a motorcycle, both dirt bike and a street bike, and I play with my wife. I do not speak for other churches. I don't do things like this. I wouldn't do this if it was at another church. I don't ever travel to speak, and I never speak when I'm off on vacation. I tried that once because I have four boys and I went to a Christian camp. God, that was like, my kids left early and they said, you ever try to do the family thing and ministry again? We're out. So when I'm gone from the church, I'm gone, I'm with my family. Now it's changing because my boys are now in college. My youngest is away in college, so it's a little bit different. A Harley Davidson, right? Yeah, that's all I want. Why would you waste your time on something else? I don't know. That's some stupid Honda. Yeah, okay, what? Hey, could the executive ministry team pretend like they listen to me? Okay, go ahead. Shift like in the early 90s? With worship and... I am not a nice person. I am a great visionary, and I am tough, and I am a badger, and I can out-endure opposition, and that's pretty much what I do. I just, I'd love to say I finessed it. I did not finesse it. I believed I was around enough senior pastors to observe that worship was changing in 90, and that bands were there, and so I was smart enough that one of the elders in our church's kid played in the first band. Because everybody hated drums when you bring in drums into the church. But you know what? It wasn't like an obstacle. I mean, it wasn't like a choice. You know, music changed in the 90s, and bands were the way it was going. And, you know, we have a choir, and, you know, we bring them in, and we have, but you know what? Bands are the way it is. And so if you came to our church, it was a band. Well, we shifted in the 90s. Well, what church liked that? No. So it was like mostly they just, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, isn't running a church kind of like the shootout at OK Corral? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, who's going to draw first and who's willing to die? And so it's like, and I don't, you know, and you know, really, if you're not willing to play hard and throw down, you shouldn't try a change. You can't just try changes. But you have to have in your church a system that says being relevant and being innovative has a value. If I didn't have that value, they could beat me up. But, you know, there was a lot of those changes, which was like, you know what? It's either you or me, and one of us is going to die. And I think it's you. And that's how I know some people, and I'll tell you the other side. I don't, you know, for a lot of the times when I started as a senior pastor, I wasted a lot of my time trying to beat other people. In fact, I picked my nemesis. I have a good friend that I went to seminary with, and he's a guy that, he is this nice guy, and he remembers everybody's name, and he's charming, and he's diplomatic, and he's political, and that's how he runs his life, and he's successful pretty much that way. I am not diplomatical, and I don't speak very well either. I'm not diplomatic. I am really not too nice, and I don't remember people's names. And it just, you know what, it's a tough thing. But, you know, I beat myself up in the first years going, oh, man, I can't do this, I can't do it. Now I just go, you know what, the good news is the church is so big I don't have to remember people's names. And so I don't. And so people come up and they go, you know, you got to, if somebody says, I want you to remember my name, I'll do that. But pretty much I can't. Right. No, that was since I came. See, that was one of my five values. We're going to be innovative. We're going to be relevant. And that was 84. Well, I had got it good and built in. By the time 90, that was 6 years ingrained into the church. You can tell people. I said, we'll never build buildings that we can't tear down. But when people threw themselves on the building over at Newport, and we can't leave it. And 400 of them left when we said we're going to change. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
When you did the merger,
yeah.
How many staff did you keep that you inherited from here? And any? Did any of them stay with you?
We have one. I'll give you the statistics. What was the merger? The mergers are never mergers, they're never equal. Every book will tell you it's always one entity taking over the other entity. And that's what books say. And it turned out that way. At the end of the day, we kept a few staff people from South Coast. We tried to take as many as we could. In the long run, only one has stayed, and he's right over there. Raise your hand, Chris. He's the only one from the original. And in people-wise, you know, there was maybe 3,200 people attending every Sunday from Mariners, and there's probably 800 that came from South Coast when it was all said and done. There were two churches that were hostile plants out of the merger. One we made amends with and one we never made amends with, but two staff that just said, I'm out of here, and, you know, planted churches because they didn't like it. Which is God's way. I mean, you know, there's no bad thing in that. Yeah.
Another question about the change of the piano and pipe organ. Did it ever cross your mind trying to keep both for a while? Did you say, no, we're going contemporary?
Right. The question is, and you're going to get a real hard story from me on this. I have no tolerance, so there's just me. All right. The question is, in the shifting of worship style, did you ever try to go halfway? I have this philosophy. Halfway is just no way. All you're doing is getting beat up from both sides. Because you go halfway, and the people who want the hymns and things that, you know, 1954 is next year, they're never going to be happy, so just let them go to another church. And then the people who want the bands are always going, why are you doing that? If you're going to be a part of what is today, there's only one kind of music that is contemporary today, and it is what you hear on Christian radio stations, and it is band-driven. That's just the way it is. So if you want to be halfway, be halfway. But what my opinion is you kind of divide your church. And if you, churches that do two services, because I go to them, I'm fascinated by churches who try it, and I think, guy, have they signed up? I mean, it's just like taking a hammer and going whack, whack to your hand every week. Because the people that get the contemporary service is all young, and the people who are doing the hymn service is old and boring, and they're split. And you go, that guy's just getting beat up every week. Why would you do that to yourself? So you do that, have at it. Not me, man. I'm not into that. I'm going forward. I think it's 2006, and next year is going to be 2007. It's not 1954 one more time. So I'm not going there. What do you think of that, huh? That's right. You want to know my opinion on the subject? That's it! That's the kind of leader I am, too. And so when I work with the staff, I kind of talk to them that way, too. Yeah? No formal membership. Actually, we ask people to join, and we say, you're a member, but we do not keep the books. And so we, you know, membership is about people that are involved, and so we have a class, and we ask people to sign a piece of paper, because it's important, and there are transitional state. You know, each one of these, you know, when somebody is reached, we want them to belong. They come to a class that's called New to Mariners, and they actually sign a piece of paper and say, I'm in, but we don't track it, because what keeps them in? The answer is them. Yeah, if they get involved in ministry, if they consider this church to be their church, they stay. And that can be this week, and next week they can go, I don't like it, and they're gone. And it doesn't matter if you keep them on a roll. So we just keep track of Sunday attendance and don't try to keep formal membership. It costs too much money, quite frankly. It is way too expensive in any church, I think, and especially a church this size, to just manage that. You know, takes a big computer thing and all that jazz. And I'm very computer literate. Are you guys supposed to answer these, or am I supposed to answer? How's it supposed to work? They're supposed to, okay. Show a little help here, okay? Yeah. Yeah. The levels, the idea is the level of pastors that we have. And what we do is we have two sides, obviously. We have an administration side. We kind of keep it away from the ministry side because it gets hard when they get together. And so administration's job is to run the church, you know, basically keep insurance the buildings as cheap as it can. And every good thing they do, it gets leveraged into a God-changing dollar. So, you know, we beat the crud out of the administrative side to get it to the ministry side. The levels is we have executive, you have the senior pastor, then you have two executive pastors, one that manages this team, and then one that manages the administrative side, and another one that manages kind of the future vision of the church. So there's actually three executive pastors. And then there's this level, and these people run the rest of the pastoral staff. Below them are pastors and directors and kind of interns. And so the church is in the hands of these people, the ministry. And so everything the church does comes out of them, and they meet two times a month. They meet two times a month and only once with me because I'm very dangerous to be in meetings with. So they actually manage an agenda so that I'm only addressing issues they think is important for me to address. They keep me out of things because, you know, I'm like the 800-pound gorilla. Does that answer your question? I'm going to. In fact, these are the breakout leaders, all right? And they're going to tell you, do you guys want to do that now? And then you can maybe ask them questions because this goes